This is an LACTO Forum production.
Welcome to Exception Handlers, the podcast where CTOs debug the challenges that keep us up at night. I'm Alex.
And I'm Bill.
And joining us today is Josh Nissenson, the head of engineering at 3x Media. Josh, great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to the chat.
Sounds good. So I think what we want to do in today's episode is examine established engineering practices kind of through the lens of AI to try to answer this one important question. How does AI change what we all used to think was a good idea? And I know you have a lot of stuff to say about this, so let's just get into it. Let's just kind of start with the first area, which is, you know, automating stuff, right? And just to set this up, you know, I think conventionally we've all always thought that having humans in the loop, eyes on every ticket or error, was kind of the gold standard for quality. But in the era of AI and the fact that it can react and instantly kind of change course, what is the right way to think about it?
I think it's a great question, but I think we have to adjust. We can't go too far on one side of the spectrum or the other, but we have to alter our behaviors now. And we have to say, what can AI do for us that takes away the arduous tasks that we used to do? We used to spend time diving deep into these tickets, looking deep into logs, looking at stack traces, things like that. And you don't have to do that anymore. Certainly, you don't have to spend as much time doing it because AI can assess, analyze, deep dive, Sherlock Holmes the heck out of that stuff, and then present you with options. You don't even have to be told what to do. You can decide between multiple routes based on the information it provides. So an example might be, you know, an error that your exception handler captures, you know, from your UI or something like that, right? You know, in the past, you would get an alert, and if it was severe enough, you would react to the alert. Maybe it was customer facing. It was causing them to have some outage or downtime or something. And so you would sort of keep your eye on Slack or whatever alerting mechanism you had. And then nowadays, you kind of can automatically react to that with AI. So the exception can be caught, you know, that alert can be tracked, can be converted into work. It can be analyzed. It can be, you know, prepared. And then a human can look at it. So that's what, when I say the spectrum, I just mean we shift our focus and we allow AI to do a lot of that grunt work that we use. We'd have to log in to a system, you know, a cloud-based system or something else to look at the logs. We'd have to pull up the tool, you know, LogRocket or Datadog or whatever, you know, CloudWatch or whatever else. And now we don't really have to do that as much. You know, we may do that sometimes, but a lot of that can be done for us and then packaged and presented. So I think it saves time and a lot of that arduous work we used to do. And I think engineering leaders and teams basically have to change their minds into how do they structure those mechanisms so that AI can work for them effectively, right? Because still having a Slack channel with 1,000 alerts, you know, people sort of get used to ignoring those things. So even if your AI tooling is responding to those alerts and doing things, you still need somebody to manage the output of that, right? So When I'm talking about the spectrum, I mean, we've got to shift our focus on the spectrum to where the work matters. And in this case, it shifts it to, okay, now AI has done the investigation, has told me what's wrong. What do I need to do next? Maybe it's review a PR. Maybe it's fix an environment variable. Maybe it's go into a system and change some architectural thing. But it changes sort of the focus of the team and how we operate with a lot of those things. I'll pause for a second and let you ask follow-up questions if you want, but I also want to articulate just some of the things I'm automating on a day-to-day basis to sort of help people see how I myself have shifted my mindset for these things and I'm trying to adapt to the use of AI.
So on a very, very simple terms, what I'm hearing is that you're looking at AI right now as a way to replace tasks, not people. It's a leverage tool that humans are using to do what they do better, faster, more efficiently, et cetera. Is that correct?
Yeah, my goal is not to let people go. It's not to cut my team or my budget as a result of the tools. It's just, in my mind, it's a way to make them operate faster and more efficiently, just to increase throughput, increase results, get better end product user experiences or better tooling or better systems as a result of these things doing a lot of the work we had to do before. It's, you know, it's shifting the mindset to be more product focused, I would say, and maybe less engineering focused, because a lot of the sort of tasks, as you called them, can be done by AI now. But, you know, I think a lot of, we've seen a lot in the news of companies laying people off, cutting staff, you know, basically going AI first everywhere. And my mindset is a little different. I think AI doesn't replace any of my engineers. I think AI just turns them all into superheroes is the best way to say it. You know, if they're using it effectively. So it just kind of really increases a lot of their natural abilities already, and they can put a lot more effort into core areas that may move the product forward faster.
So let me just kind of ask the question that I think probably a lot of people who hear this think. So that sounds amazing in theory, right? So you've got this awesome agent that is keeping an eye on things. And when it detects a problem, it does the deep dive, figures out root cause, does the five whys, comes back to you with a couple of recommendations, and you're like, option A, and off we go to production. Of course, things don't always work out. Things hallucinate. And I guess it's just the kind of the natural question here is like, yes, human has to be in the loop, but what is the human doing exactly? How much do you expect the human to be, first of all, checking the work just at kind of the basic level, right? Like option A or option B, which one's right? But also, like, how much do you trust the analysis? How much do you expect the human to actually follow up on? Is this even an issue, or is this even an issue worth fixing, or what have you?
That's a great question. One side of this coin is simply that I always ask in any of these investigations, I ask the AI to give me a confidence score. So I say, when you're producing this bug, tell me your percentage, you know, confidence that this fix will solve it. And I'm not saying I believe everything that it says in terms of its confidence level. Just as it can hallucinate the solution, it can hallucinate the confidence level, right? But I sort of try to give it a North Star. But to answer your question, the human has to understand the system in order to evaluate the result of that work. So you need somebody who knows, like they have to review what we just had this last week. We had an automated Sentry alert that got turned into a GitHub issue that then got 85% confidence on a GitHub PR, and which was then auto assigned to one of the members of my team. And they reviewed it and they're like, this is not the right solution. This doesn't solve the problem at all. And so, you know, that happens 100%. But I would say we're probably about 80% success rate right now of the PR actually solving the problem through this automated process. So, you know, for me, that's good enough. But I do need people that understand the code, understand the system, and need to be able to review it holistically and end to end. Now, one thing we have built, which sort of is part of our topical discussion today, which I'm a huge fan of, is pre-merge environments and or preview if you're used to Vercel. What that means is when the PR is created automatically, it spins up an automatic environment where this can typically be tested. So it's not just I'm reviewing the PR, it's I can click into this and I can see the result of the PR live, either with an automated test checking it or with a manual person going in and looking, or the reviewer of the PR clicking into the pre-merge link, going and evaluating, did this actually solve it? Assuming it's something that's reproducible, of course. But you create an ecosystem of analysis that's not just line-by-line code, because as we all know, you know, AI agents have a tendency to be verbose in their answers. So like if you try to evaluate line-by-line code, sometimes you can get hit with massive PRs, right? Yeah. And then you end up needing AI to tell you what this AI did.
Right.
What's happening?
So two questions there. Question one, I mean, this all sounds pretty, let's say, token intensive. And I'm wondering just how do you manage the spend around all this?
That's a great question. I mean, I just put limits. So in GitHub Actions, you can actually set a token limit. So basically, I set a token limit on any investigation. And if it goes above it, it says zero confidence and it does not create a PR. And then a human has to go in. So if it can't solve it quickly through, I think I gave it a 16 iteration cycle with a max of 30,000 tokens on the investigation. If it can't get to it in that, then it's a complex issue that needs a human to probably look into it to resolve.
So I really quickly, you said, just for clarification, you said a 16 cycle limit. Are you doing looping logic?
Yeah. So like what happens-
That's kind of key too, yeah.
Yeah, what happens is, so we're automatically checking out the repo, right? So the agent needs access to the repo. So it looks at the sentry error, it checks in the GitHub action, it checks out the repo, it evaluates the error against the repo, and in many cases, multiple repos. It might need, let's say it's a UI and an API, it might need to see both. So it may have to check out multiple repos. So the cycle is the analysis of the bug assessment, basically,
right, looping exactly through, yep,
and trying to detect. So I give it a limit, basically, and a token and a cycle limit. And I don't use the most expensive models either. I go back several models and I lock it at that model. And I do some experimentation with which models are effective at bug solving, for example.
And just to be clear on the tooling, maybe you said this and I missed it. Are these like homegrown sort of agents you're using, or are you using some sort of an other?
No, I'm just using, I'm just using Claude in this case, Claude
Okay,
code.
So you just have Claude running, kind of being alerted about sentry errors or what have you, and then prompting it to do the rest of it, basically.
Yeah, and I'm using in between. I was going to talk about this too. I'm using N8N, which I just saw yesterday got this huge evaluation because SAP invested in it. But I'm using N8N. So N8N is the one that's listening for the webhook from Sentry. So a webhook comes in, and then N8N steps through. It creates the issue, and it does a prelude to the eval. It does a very quick first assessment. It captures all the data. It creates the issue. Then it hands off to the next stage, which does the iteration and does so. So I'm hooked up with N8N and GitHub Actions. The GitHub Action is where the repository checkout happens, where the assessment, and then N8N sort of hooks up the end-to-end completeness of like deciding on the confidence and creating the issue and following up and putting a badge and alerting people. So there's kind of a combination of technologies in use there. And, you know, to your point, you know, you have to be careful with your token utilization and your API key spend. And Claude does this separate thing between, you know, your Claude AI and Claude Cowork utilization across your business, as well as API key, you know, for N8N and other stuff. So you got to be aware of both of those things. They separate the costs. So that does come into play. But you guys will laugh at this. As part of automation, I have an N8N job that assesses all of the engineering spend every day, including on AI. So I look at every system and it's in an updating spreadsheet, and I look for variants. And so if I get variants, then I tell N8N to send me an email that says like your spend increased, you know, X over Y or whatever in this last day. So I'm a very huge fan of automation and sort of, you know, building out an ecosystem of making things easier for people. So, you know, you don't have to go into all those systems to find your costs and stuff like that. And this is all a part of what I call the ecosystem of, you know, automate everything that you can so that your people can focus on the highest value areas is essentially what I look for. So I said before, and when we were talking on email, I created a Slack channel called Things That Suck. And the idea behind that Slack channel is for everybody in the company to basically post things that bother them about their daily, you know, manual work, not about other coworkers, of course, just about their manual work. And so the idea is that the end result of those discussions will lead us to automations, right? Around, you know, it could be N8N, it could be Claude Cowork.
I assume you don't already have an agent running against that Slack channel, picking up those complaints automatically and just converting them into automation.
It's not busy enough, but if it got there, yes, I would.
Yeah.
You can feel the pranks coming on from here.
Indeed. So actually, maybe this is a good time to transition to our second topic, sure, which is around kind of development environments and managing your development environments, right? So just to tee this up again, you know, we've all kind of for years and years and years now have been pushed towards kind of cloud native as the only way to scale. And that has certain complications that it introduces in how you develop locally. What does AI do to that? How does this picture change?
It's a really great question. It's something I love talking about and I'm passionate about. And, you know, I think when all of these big companies, whether it's Amazon or Google Cloud or, you know, whoever else, and GitHub got into it with GitHub Actions and sort of but there's all kinds of, you know, providers for CI, you know, CI systems, CI workflows. I think, you know, I talk to my colleagues a lot about this and people I've worked with before about, you know, like if you create too much reliance on the cloud services, right? Like, what do you do when there's an outage? Can you still release to your platform when one of these providers has an outage? And so I have a friend that I talk to about tech stuff every day, and he always says to scale up and out, you have to scale down. And the point of that statement is building out developer tooling that allows you to run as many things locally as you can. So, you know, in my case, I use OrbStack. You know, a lot of people use Docker Desktop or whatever for local stuff. You can do Kubernetes or you can do other kinds of services and systems there. But the idea is, can I run most of my stack and even simulated, can I do it locally? Can I mimic different environments by changing environment variables? Can I use tooling? Can I use mock data? Can I simulate the entire ecosystem? Now, for some apps, this might be incredibly challenging to do. You know, like Uber or something comes to mind, where you have geolocational stuff and you have, you know, event-based pricing and time-based pricing and all kinds of things that would present really unique engineering challenges. But for your common web applications, I think a lot of the things that people do in CI can be done locally. You know, you can mimic a lot of those things. So I love, you know, can I run my automated tests? Can I run all my tests against it, you know, locally? Can I mimic, you know, like changing environments? Like, can I mimic a production bug potentially locally on my machine? And all of that is to say, like, if I can do that, then my CI systems, they just become representative of like my local Mac. It's just, it's almost like it's, you know, even though it's out in some deployed environment, it's mimicking almost exactly what I, in fact, I could use, I did this at my last job. I could use my local tools that I built to interact with that deployed environment, whether it was, you know, on my machine or not, it was almost identical. So building the tooling out that allows your developers to do as much as possible like locally just gives so much power. And then you can advance and adapt your ecosystem so that, you know, like you're a great example from my past is visual diffing. So like, you know, like when you change something, like let's say it's just a simple CSS property, your button goes from red to green, right? Well, a lot of times you have CSS properties that are shared. Maybe you only intended one button to be green and now everything on your site became green. Without, you know, and it wasn't what you intended. But how do you detect that? How do you know that? Do you just have to wait for QA or somebody to manually pick it up or whatever? Or can you actually automate that? Can you automate that locally? Can you detect it? Can you detect visual diffs? And there's so many tools out there now that allow you to do these kinds of things. You know, there's Playwright, which takes, you can do screenshots and analysis and comparison. There's Cypress, there are like testing frameworks. There's actual services that are built around this. I think Argos and Percy do visual diffing services, like SaaS services you can build in. So there's just so many things that you can do to enhance your developer experience, your product, UX, developer ecosystem in terms of how you build stuff. And then also your signal of like, how much you break your app over time accidentally and catching that before your customers do. So again, it all starts local. Can I reproduce it local? That's the point of what I'm trying to say.
Well, and to kind of dive down a little bit, it's a bit of a sidebar, but one of the things that I've always found challenging in doing that in the past is data. Have you spent any time working with AI to create synthetic data, or data that you use specifically for testing or in these situations? Because yeah, there's the dynamic stuff. And even there, you know, approximating that is something that can be very difficult, but just a lot of the core company data for various reasons, you can't have it locally, or it's just difficult to come in and reproduce that specific situation.
Great question. And there's a lot of pieces to this. So, you know, when you're working with compliance services like Avanta or
exactly.
a somebody, you know, you're doing SOC 2, you have to, they ask you, you know, are you, do you have PII, or, you know, how are you handling our data? How is it being stored? You know, like, how is it being in transit? You know, like GDPR, you have to deal with these questions too. So yeah, it's something that we have to think about a lot. And especially being in ad tech, we have to think about this quite a bit, because we're sort of anonymizing, you know, like the user inside of a segment, right? Like, so by a segment, I mean like a shoe buyer, or, you know, somebody who's went to fast food last week or whatever, right? But so we have to anonymize a lot of that stuff. So what we do is we have a service we call a Shadow DB, where we anonymize real world data into the Shadow DB for test and deploy purposes, basically for development. So we have this Shadow DB that anonymizes, you know, anything that's personal, and then we can run migrations against it. We can do, you know, we can alter a column or add an index or do all kinds of things, and we don't have to worry about, you know, like somebody basically saying we flagged a compliance mistake or something like that. So yeah, we have to think about that, and we have to think about, you know, because we work with a lot of third-party providers, right? Like in the ad tech world, right, we're calling into lots of demand side platforms to get, whether it's reporting data to interface with campaign management or whatever. So we have to be very aware of what we're pulling from the different providers and what they give to us, and then what we say we do with data, right, for compliance purposes. So this is a very real world concern, and something that we take into account. And we also have contractors and developers that are not full-time, you know, employees and things like that, that are in other countries. And so we have to think, what are the rules and the laws there, and how do we manage the data that they have access to and stuff. So yeah, this is something that we spend time on from a development practice standpoint. And I think most companies do this, but we have, you know, a multi-environment state. Basically, we have what we call non-prod. Think of it as like the staging environment, and then we have prod. And the non-prod stuff is where the data is anonymized, where it's changed, where it's manipulated, tested, where we have these pre-merge environments, you know. And then prod, of course, is the real world customer data. So we segregate that way, but we do spend time into thinking about how does this data take shape, and how do we anonymize it?
Makes sense.
Okay, well, so I mean, I guess that I think covers that topic pretty well. So I want to move on to the last topic, which is around practices and ceremonies, right? So, and again, let me just kind of tee this off. I think it's true that for years and years and years, we've all believed that, you know, agile practices are the way to do things, and you need a bunch of specialists. Well, most of us have believed this.
Some of us are, of course, rebels, but most
anything
of us
with a fixed meeting loses Bill.
Yeah, most of us have drunk the agile Kool-Aid and all believe in the practices and the roles, and also in the kinds of people you tend to hire as far as your engineering team, right? Specialists, people who are real experts on stuff. And again, given that AI can do everything, and, you know, as now my favorite saying, AI can do everybody else's jobs poorly. How should this change? That. What should we be doing instead? How do you think about that?
Yeah, and this is a great question. I think you'll have many people on, you know, multiple sides of the table here, or the coin, that have very unique and differing perspectives. My perspective is that, and I've been, you know, for 15 years, I've been doing, you know, sprints and daily stand-ups and retros and demos and all that jazz across, you know, 10 different companies, right? And, you know, everybody sort of adopted these things. And even all the tooling, whether it was Jira or other tools, you know, surrounding these ceremonies, although Basecamp kind of went against it. But I guess what I would say is the reason behind all of that, and the reason that Agile became so popular, was that it just helped people get organized, right? It, like, you prepped basically for this small block of time. You would scope things, quote, groom them, prepare them. You would do all of this front loading work so that then the team could go in and basically either self-assign the work or you know, a lead or a product leader, somebody could essentially break it down and then say, okay, I think, you know, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. You know, each team would operate differently. But the goal typically behind all of that was to become organized and to function efficiently and perform at a high rate, like deliver value, quote, to the customer every couple of weeks or every sprint or whatever, right? But to me, what has changed so massively with AI is that so much of that grooming and so much of that organization is no longer required. You could have 60 tickets of work and you could feed that to your agent or multi-agents and you could say, I need to do 60 tickets on this specific topical area. We could call it an epic or whatever you want to call it from the nomenclature. A boulder, some people might call it, a big group of work, you know, some major feature. And all of that would be, you know, prepped and packaged in a way that's easy for a human to understand. You would have a parent-child relationship for these tickets. They would be organized in a way where you could sort of take one at a time and work your way through it. And then when all of them are done, you could sort of say the feature's done or it's ready to be, you know, observed or whatever. But you don't need to operate that way anymore. Like the agents don't need that. They don't need that. They could do the UI, the API, the data, the database, they could do it all in parallel if you give it a certain kind of guidance. So you no longer really need the same structure. You don't need pointing systems. You don't need pre-grooming. As long as the upfront work is done well by the humans, you know, to articulate what the requirements really are for the thing, your agents can do a lot of work hand in hand with the humans, but you could have a huge block of these things that can then be executed by a single individual that no longer need that structure, you know? And so for me, the structures are just changing so much because of AI. I don't need this, you know, like sprint planning the way that I needed it before. Things can still be organized, but you could have AI organize your board for you. You could basically tell it, here's my team structure, here's the context, here's the skills of the group, go ahead and organize the board based on this. You could even have swim lanes assigned to people if you wanted, and all of that could be automatically done in a couple hours by an agent, you know? So you just don't need the same structures you needed before for organization. So it sort of throws a lot of that out the window. And not only that, like in terms of demo, in terms of output, in terms of reporting, in terms of documentation, all of that can be written or performed or executed or tested by agents. So you don't need that side of it either. So when I say big picture, I mean, now it becomes, what's the end goal we're trying to accomplish for this product, right? Like this feature. And then now that individual humans are now looking at that bigger picture, they're assessing the quality of the work, they're testing it manually themselves, they're looking at the code results, they're maybe testing it locally. So it just changes the roles and the goals of the entire team, in my opinion, in terms of structure.
You know, we are living through the age of first principles. I cannot tell you how many conversations we've been a part of in the last few months where it's like, why are we doing this? Is the question of the day. What is the point of all this? What was this trying to accomplish originally? And that first principles thinking, you kind of have to do everywhere. And it's certainly something as intense as agile practices. So related to all this, right? So totally get the point about, hey man, you don't need a lot of these artifacts and ceremonies because either the agents can do it or they no longer serve the purpose. You know, it's just unnecessary. But very much related to that is the kinds of people you have and who is involved. So the conversation that I feel like we've had like five times in the last 2 months, Bill and I, is this whole thing about product engineering are coming together into a new blob of uncertainty. And what does it look like to be an engineer? What does it mean to be an engineer? What does it look like to be a product person? Where are the boundaries? Are product people doing engineering work? Are engineers doing product work? How do you see that? What is your view of all this?
Yeah, it's a really interesting topical area. And I think this is something we're discussing in almost every community I'm part of that's technology focused, CTO forum, things like that. And, you know, where I land is this, I no longer, when I have headcount open up and I need to hire, I no longer look for an engineer that is a React expert or a Node expert or a framework or a Python expert or whatever. I look for people that have greater system understanding and awareness and greater customer understanding and awareness and can sort of ask questions across surface areas. So I guess the simple way to say it from our past is a greater generalist focus rather than a specialist focus. And so that's how I talk to people. That's how I interview them. When I ask them questions in interviews, it's not about, you know, if it's a coding sample, it's not a coding sample where I'm looking at how they manage React state. I don't care. Like, that can be done by agents now. Like, what I care now is, can that developer understand, you know, the UI, the API, the database, CI, you know, like developer practices, tooling, scripting, working with agents, understanding the AI, actually the AI ecosystem itself, because it's changing all the time. We have 1,000 different tools, you know, on the command line now, and 1,000 different approaches with, you know, plugins and skills and, you know, like agents MD or these markdown files and everything else. So I'll pause for a second so you guys can riff off this, because I think there's some questions.
Well, in my mind, what I'm hearing you say, and it's something that has been consistent with conversations I've had with other CTOs, and that is for those of us who believe that AI is a tool to enhance the abilities of the people we have, the true value that humans are bringing is context. And as your point you just made is that the context can be wider understanding of the technical chain, more understanding of the different tools involved, but even zooming out a little bit farther, it's like, what does this mean to the company? You know, there may be some history associated with something, or, you know, we ran down the path and our customers hated that. And there's no way for that historical information to be, you know, woven into every prompt so that the AI knows what it's working with.
100%. I think for me, it means a shift. So like in the past, I might have hired people that maybe were not as extroverted, were not as great communicators, you know, like maybe did English wasn't even their first language and they had a hard time, but they were such specialists with a specific tool or a specific approach to coding a certain surface area that was so valuable for us because they could do things that others couldn't with the code. And now it's just changed. I'm looking for more people who question broadly, people who ask about the customer, people who want to know what we're trying to accomplish as a business, people who want to sort of see from idea to customer, right? Like the end to end.
Well, and taking that into kind of a little bit more of a bumper sticker, but English is becoming the ultimate abstraction.
Yeah, because you're providing context.
Everything you're doing, you're interacting with something. The code is there, and you know it's there, and you do investigate occasionally. But the more important thing is that you're talking about a subject. You're talking about it functioning things, but you're doing it as a story.
And just to bring up the language thing, so I am in the process of a side company. I'm launching a vodka in Brazil called Da Bomb Vodka, and I'm helping like build the ERP and the CRM systems and the website and connecting it to WhatsApp and Facebook and Meta apps and, you know, everything in the technology ecosystem to sort of build a group business from there. But it's in a different language. It's in Portuguese, right? So I have to basically think in those terms and I have to present in those terms and the people I'm working with. And so I'm not used to that. So I have to sort of cross language boundaries. And in some cases I have to ask the agents, can you translate this to Portuguese so I can then present it to the people that I'm working with, you know? So even across these language boundaries, it's becoming so interesting how we're using the agents and what we're working with.
Let me just channel my inner Bill here and say, look, this is all well and good, but you know, I just heard today an interesting quote about we're creating a generation of engineers who cannot debug their own code because they actually don't know the particulars of it, and left to their own devices, they wouldn't know where to start. And that's, I mean, it's a concern, right? How big a concern or how real a concern, I think, is the question here. But what do you think about that? So like, I hear you 100% and I actually almost entirely agree with the point of like, we have to, I have generalists who really understand the context, the business context, maybe the architectural context of the system, but certainly not the nitty-gritty of how React manages its state. That doesn't matter. But then there are people who say, well, that means that the code base is now a mystery box. And if your agent is offline, you're in a world of hurt as an engineer. And where is that responsibility?
There's two sides of this discussion I want to bring up. So one is we have, you know, some of us have children that are either in college or about to go into college. And some that I know, some of my friends that like are computer science majors in college right now. And they're like, what do I learn? Because clearly the importance of the language is no longer the same. It's not the same as it was before. So that's one side of the coin is like, what should people even study and learn as they're coming into this industry of technology and coding and AI? And the flip side of that is, yeah, I think, do frameworks even matter? Like React, you know, or Svelte or Vue or whatever, you know, or Node or Bun or whatever, you know, like, are these things even going to matter in the future? Because as the frameworks sort of change and the core language becomes more useful by the AI, you don't need all of this abstractive layer on top of it. You know, like AI can build the same things you need to without 100,000 dependencies and external third-party libraries on top of it. So you start minimizing the code bases in terms of the dependencies you need, but maybe you make it way more complex for an individual human to go in and there and then read and understand. So you're 100% right. And I don't know actually what the, I wish I had the right answer for this because I'm facing it myself, which is every week that goes by, I'm coding less and I'm conducting the agents more. You know, like I feel like I'm leading the orchestra or whatever. And even myself, I'm losing touch with, I just built a feature and half of it was probably built entirely by AI, every line. And the other half, it's like, well, I knew what I was doing in this area, so I could easily modify things. But and I presume in the future, it'll be more and more and more. So that means I will lose touch with what it means. Now, what I would say is there's benefit to my past history of understanding the languages, right? Like I've worked with JavaScript for many years. I can look at a React, you know, component, or I can look at an API controller and understand what it's trying to accomplish. But as time goes on or as new people come into the industry that don't have the same experience, you're right. Like they're going to start relying more and more and more on AI. And so where's the line drawn of like what their technology skill needs to be in order to be effective?
I feel like our generation of engineers has this incredible, in retrospect, advantage of having to have done it manually for decades. And sort of by hook or by crook, learning the hard lessons that you get when you have to write all this code by hand and all the architectural and systems understanding you get with that and all that. But like, how could you possibly develop that stuff if you didn't have to do it by hand? I keep thinking, like, if I had to go through the last 20 or whatever, 30 years of software with AI, I probably wouldn't know most of what I know just simply because why would I have learned it?
The ramifications for that ultimately would be very interesting.
In 20 years, it'll be something. Once this generation sort of hangs up the old gloves, like, yeah, I don't know what happens.
Well, and to be fair, we've seen a little bit of a preface to this in the big outsourcing rage that happened, you know, in the early 2000s, where you had entire IT departments start to get outsourced, and then corporate lost track of how things actually worked, and it did started creating problems.
Yeah, but at least there were some human beings somewhere in the world who presumably looked at the code and knew how it worked. That's no longer true. And it's becoming less true by the day.
I agree. And I think the thing that we have to figure out, I guess, is, you know, where, like as a leader, right, like of an engineering organization, I have to sort of establish culture, principles, behavioral models. Like, how do we interact? So one of the things I do every month is I have an engineering all-team meeting, right? And in the all-team meeting, we sort of discuss how are we using AI and many other topics. Like, what can we do? What I always say is, if each developer can do one thing to impact the team positively every month, by the end of 6 months, you'll see so many massive improvements, it'll shock you. But people don't think like that. They just get into their tickets, their focus areas, and just like delivering. And I like to say, you know, step back and think about how can you enhance the ecosystem for everybody else. But as a result of that, I think where developers today can learn the most is in debugging, right? Like even if you didn't write the code, if you're able to effectively walk through where this issue happens and then unwind from that and then come up with a proposed fix and even tell the AI agent, this is what I think should be fixed, you know, like then you still have a handle on the code base and the ecosystem. But
I guess we've come full circle because we started this conversation with let AI do your debugging for you. So you pick one or the other. But yes, your point's very well taken. And I absolutely appreciate it. I think this actually covers the topics we wanted to get into today. This is a really good conversation. I really appreciate your time. And I hope you had a good time with us.
Awesome. Really enjoyed it. Thank you both for having me. It was a total pleasure to be here. And I love these kinds of discussions. Hopefully it comes across. I'm passionate about this stuff. So
Definitely. Yeah. Well, thank you. And if you found topics covered in this interview relevant to you, LA CTO Forum has lots of opportunities to engage with other CTOs about topics just like this one. If you want to learn more, find us on LinkedIn or on the web at lactoforum.org. Until next time, may your deployments be smooth and your tech debt manageable.
And remember, if you can't handle the exception, at least log it properly. We'll catch you next time.